Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, April 16th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 150?
150!
What? How are we at 150? What is time? That doesn't even count the bonus pods. It doesn't even count the article reads.
Yeah, it's got to be like 180 if you count
like
those.
We're being honest, like what's in the feed, you know what I'm saying? It is almost tax day here in the United States, so everyone is nervous. It's been pouring rain, the subways have been flooded, but we are still bringing you Waypoint Radio from our apartments. We've all retreated to our apartments. It's me, Austin Walker, joining me, Danielle Riendo.
Hi, I have almost dried up from this morning. Almost there.
There's at least been two changes of clothes today,
at
I
least,
think, for everybody.
Actually, I've changed my socks like three times today
Fair. Also joining us, Snowy Patrick Klepek.
Well, it was this morning, and now that snow has mostly just... Yesterday was weird because it started out, it was raining all weekend, and then the temperature slowly dropped, so you actually got to watch the precipitation change in real time from rain to sleet to ice chunks to snow.
And now back the other way.
Now we're heading in the other direction when it inevitably warms to like in the 40s. This week. I am pro winter, but pick a season. God damn it.
I have a war against winter. But
you do.
Still.
You have a war on winter. It's true. Danielle's war on winter. I heard about it on Fox and Friends. Really just trying to take the winter away from us. You know, even though.
That's
even
Scott
though
Pruitt.
That's true. That's accurate. God. I was going to make like a joke about the dragon eating the sun and bringing up, but it's actually wolves that eat the sun in Norse mythology, right? The wolves eat the sun and the moon, and then Ragnarok comes. I think that's how that goes. I know that because I just finished playing God of War, a game that does a lot of shit with Norse mythology. Patrick, you ran a review on the site last week. It was in the podcast feed, and you and Rob had a really good conversation about it, also in the podcast feed. Just as a reminder to people who maybe like see those things, like, I'm good, I read it on the site, or I'm good, I don't need to hear Austin or Patrick or Danielle or Rob read whatever they wrote in my ears. There's always, going forward, since the last... God, what was the first one? I guess it was Monster Hunter. Since the beginning of this year, whenever we do one of those article reads, it's always paired with a conversation between Rob, who hosts that podcast now, and whoever did the read, or a guest if it was a Rob thing. So like I interviewed him for the MLB The Show one. Please listen to those. They're great. They're really focused. But I mean, I didn't get to talk to you, Patrick, about it, or you, Danielle, who cut the video review version of it, which is up on our YouTube.
So I'm very intimately familiar with like 4 hours of this.
That's fine, because those are the 4 hours that we can talk to with any real specificity because of the embargo.
And also because people can't play this game yet. Like it's one of the strange parts of this game. Yes. This game does not go on sale until like 4 a.m. on Thursday or whatever it is when it sets live in New Zealand and the PlayStation.
Right. But I beat it 4 a.m. yesterday, which means I'm eager to talk about it. So Patrick, like at the high level, you came away from this really, really liking it. It is kind of what I got from the review.
Yeah. I'm, you know,
that's
I'm
what I got from it. You know, 3 out of 5, 4 out of 5. give me the number. You know, why don't you just use?
We're
what
on
was the
Metacritic.
Fun factor, Patrick? What was the fun factor? I need to
high.
Know.
It was high. It was like spiky haired from GamePro.
From GamePro. Ooh,
oh,
wow.
Good.
Good.
It was tremendously fun. Yeah, I've always liked the God of War games more. The earlier iteration, I found I disliked it. Sort of. I think God of War 2 was sort of like the highlight of the series, which probably unsurprisingly is also the one that last one that Corey Barlog directed.
Gotcha.
you know, David Jaffe was the creative director of the first one, then Corey Barlog took over in the second one. Corey Barlog was there for a little bit of the third one and then left, and I didn't particularly like God of War. Like, God of War 3 is a grand spectacle, like, it was a really amazing showcase for the PlayStation 3, but right. for all sorts of reasons, I didn't particularly care for that third one. And Ascension, the game that came after that, was complete garbage. And but yeah, I've generally liked this series. And what's interesting about the arc of me personally is that it also sort of, there's an arc of my critical analysis of games that has changed. Like, when I played the original God of War 2005, I mean, you know, I was 20 years old. I didn't think about games like seriously at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I enjoyed games very seriously, but I was not thinking about yes. games and on anything beyond like, yo, this Kratos is a fucking badass, and I am ripping up this troll's skull, and I am bashing the shit out of the, like, that was the way I enjoyed games. I was 20 year old getting drunk in college, and right. That was like my surface level understanding and critical analysis of video games. And like, I'll like be honest in saying, like, my reaction to God of War 3 being not like, it was not necessarily because, like, this game is like extremely violent and like misogynistic, which is like true. It
looking
was more
back
just like,
on it now, yeah, that's something you can say.
Right. Like, but that's not something I was articulating himself. That was more just like, the series is getting fucking boring. Like, you can only make things so big. And that's also a like cogent analysis of where that series got itself in trouble. But like, I'm not going to pretend that like that was the reason that, that I got, right. I got tired of it.
It's weird. I played the very beginning of God of War 1, the very beginning of God of War 3. I've seen most of God of War 3. Uh-huh. It's never been the series for me. Like, I've sure. never. And so in playing this, in my first few hours where I was really, really having a good time, I was like, man, did I miss something from the previous God of Wars? Like, I've heard obviously things from people who do absolutely call it out for its misogyny and for its like, its kind of excessive love of violence. It's almost like childlike glee at snapping necks and throwing women into the gears of puzzle boxes, very literally. But like, I don't know about it. So I'm like, I'm curious what the tone is of those games and like what the writing is like. And I watched like three clips of early God of War cutscenes, and it was like, oh wow, like what we think of as writing has changed a lot in games of this size and scale. That stuff is rough. Like, I don't just mean bad in a qualitative, in like the meaning of it is like, hey, wow, Kratos is a real shithead, and they're really leaning into Kratos being a shithead as like a power fantasy. I just mean like in terms of quality, in terms of like recording quality and written quality. It was just a different time for video mm-hmm. game stories. And it's really strange to go back and look at some of that stuff now in lieu of especially this new game, which has the veneer, at least, of like prestige of Sony first party prestige game. Do you know yes. what I mean?
Like, there's a through line between like The Last of Us and Uncharted. Like, there's just a certain type of game.
There's a house style.
Yeah, there's a house style to, so like Sony's internal studios, and even if the gameplay is different between them, like there is, like you expect Sony to make these types of games, and I think arguably part of the reason Microsoft has really struggled is that they have not found a way to make or have not invested in these types of games. And right. if you own a PlayStation, like you can expect you can get quote unquote big serious games. You know what that actually means is you know, up to debate, but that is certainly part of the pitch and the veneer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that debate to me has been one of the most interesting things. It has been super interesting to see the feedback on all, you know, across the spectrum of the response this game got. So for people who maybe don't go to message boards or hang out on Twitter and look at all the different review scores, and I know there are a lot of people out there who listen to us who maybe don't do that, you know, God of War has been pretty universally acclaimed. You know, everyone, I'm looking at the Metacritic here, from Digital Chumps to Giant Bomb to Dark Station to Dual Shocker, to The Guardian, to US Gamer, to Games Radar, all of the things I'm reading right now, like there's a dozen plus perfect scores for this game. IGN, very well heralded across all of these different outlets. And some of the response has been super interesting to me, especially as I played the game, because at first, you know, a lot of there was a kind of immediate backlash from what I think of as like our corner of the Twitter like critic sphere. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of young up and coming critics who are really sharp and really bright pointed to this as like, hey, anytime you have something that is super well liked across the board in this way, and given the text of a lot of those reviews that don't necessarily say, like, a lot of the reviews didn't dig deep into why this game excels outside of a degree of polish and feel. And those things are valuable, but like, that's when it's all across the board where every critic values those same things. Does that reflect something really, like, poor in the, you know, or not poor, but a lack of diversity of voices inside of what criticism looks like, instead of games criticism? And obviously this exists in other media also. Like, there are movies that come out that are like, everybody loves them. You know, you can look at Rotten Tomatoes and see the movies that score 95% fresh or whatever.
And that's are movies that are movies that are you know, like, critic bait. Like, they're right. And I would argue that God of War, like, in some of the themes and like what people want to talk about and what people want to write about these days, like, there is a valid argument to make that, yes, like, there is and I could be just as guilty as being blinded by this, especially when you're doing these sort of reviews in a mm-hmm. like I hate one of the things I hate about reviewing games is that I find I like to have my feelings informed by what other people think too, which is not that I want my opinion to be shaped, like, exclusively by the thoughts of others, but that my like, when I write a review about God of War or anything else, like, I can only give to it, like, what my takeaway was, and I don't necessarily, I often, my final feelings on a game will be informed by, like, other opinions that brought different perspectives, or picked up on something, or highlighted something, or their value system of how they looked at the game was in a different hierarchy, and I was like, oh, right, like even immediately after writing this review, I'll be, like, perfectly honest, like, when people, like, I mentioned in my review about how the game, you know, doesn't give Kratos' wife a voice, period.
At
like, she is not present in the game. She is not, she is the primary motivation for the actions of Kratos and his son. Like, the whole plot hinges on her presence in their lives, but it is her death, and we don't witness any sort of cutscenes that, like, cut to, like, any sort of information about who she was, what she did. It is all talked about her, but that doesn't necessarily dig super deep into the series history of misogyny, because essentially what this God of War game does is it chooses to pick one tact, which is, like, I guess if you did think of God of War, like, God of War, think in your head, like, blood is one of the things that's going to come to mind. And so this game tries to reckon, or at least confront, or talk about its history of violence, but does not talk about its history of sexual violence, does not talk about its history of misogyny. I could easily see, and I acknowledge this to some folks.
I think it goes even further than that. Like, I genuinely think there is some stuff in this game that fucks up on gender that we can't talk about because it's too late in the game. I don't want to spoil it. You know what I mean? But
right,
I think that
I mean,
what I'll say that's interesting about this game in terms of structure is that it is. So I came away not liking it as much as you. I really liked the first half of it. I think it really loses itself in the second half in a major way. I think, like, the pacing falls apart. It does that. You mentioned this in the review that, like, the last half of this game is, like, go get this new magical MacGuffin, like, four times in a row. There is, like, this deferred climax over and over again, to the point where there are moments where you're like, all right, we're going to go do the thing. And then, like, literally in the animation falls apart as you're going to go do the thing. Like, oh, I guess we can't go do the thing because we need another magical dude. That and it happens, like, it defers itself again and again and again, and that's positioned in the structure that is this open world. There's lots of side activities to do, right? There's lots of, I mean, Danielle, you probably saw a lot of this footage of just, like, go do a side thing, go open a chest. Like, I don't how much footage did Patrick send you of just, like, he's figuring out a puzzle to open a chest?
Quite a bit. I mean, like, I had, I don't know, about 4 hours to work with. Which is great and awesome when you're doing, like, a 20-minute review. But, yeah, there was a lot of stuff with go to it, you know, open a chest, figure out a puzzle, talk to a ghost guy, because there's, you know, there's problems in paradise with the ghost guy. You know, that
lots
kind of thing.
Ghost guys. Lots of ghost guys have lots of ghost problems. Shout out to ghost problems. And all of that stuff, it, like, fills the game with content. There's no hour count, but I would guess 30 to 40 hours I put into this thing over the last week and a half. Because of that, it is this very big thing. Like, it is this very, not overstuffed necessarily, but it is unwieldy. It's big. There's lots to go do. But at the same time, in the story, it's actually really slight and slender. Like, there are 8, maybe 9 named characters in this game. Seriously. And one of them is a woman, and she has agency. And I think that her story ends up being really frustrating. I think we're going to see some great criticism around her story as it comes out. Because she's a character who has an arc, and her arc, like every other arc, is about family, right? Like, this is a game about family. It's a lot of mythology is about family. And I think that they dropped the ball with her in a way that was really frustrating, especially given the series' history with misogyny. And it is a focal point. Like, I think the character relationships are some of the best things about this game. It's funny, like, Patrick, you came to this game as a father and you thought a lot about fatherhood and legacy. I very much came to this game as a son, and like working through, you know, I have a great relationship with my father now. My dad listens to this podcast. Hey, Dad. He would be the first to admit that, like, there were moments as a kid where, like, we were both figuring out what it meant to have a relationship together. He went through a history of anger issues and dealt with them and, like, grew as a person in a real way. But there was a time in my life where I was afraid of my father, like, deeply afraid of my father. And I think it's, like, this sort of game touches that stuff in a way that like hit me in a way that I was shocked by, because it lined up with stories I've told here about dealing with growing up and my relationship with my father and ways in which I changed as a son to try to react to him. The stuff between Atreus and Kratos is genuinely powerful. But there are all these other ways in which it dropped the ball. And there's this lingering thought that I can't quite deal with outside of a sort of cynical response, which is like, this question has come up a lot on Twitter. Why tell Kratos' story? Like, if the creators know that this character has all this baggage around violence, around misogyny, which maybe they don't know that part, or maybe they don't want to confront that, why do we have to deal with Kratos at all? Why not begin with Atreus as the lead, or why not? And I'm not, I want to be clear, I'm not spoiling anything. Atreus as a character is kind of the focal point of this game. But, you know, why not say, we're going to tell Atreus' story and you're going to play as Atreus from a little
bit.
Right,
what if Kratos, like the end of God of War 3, like, there's a world where they could have just written it.
Close the door.
Close the door, have Kratos dead or missing or
right,
whatever.
Right, or whatever. Right. And then, it's ambiguous at the end of that game anyway, so.
Right. And it could have been the kind of game where it's like, all right, the way we're going to deal with the legacy of Kratos' violence is how does a son deal with learning
right.
the legacy.
Or a daughter,
of
or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, whatever. Totally. Like, a child. How does a child deal with the legacy of their parents, right? Like, the sins of their parents that have echoes into their own ability to live, and that could have been probably a potentially more interesting framing. You lose Kratos as on the box art. You lose Kratos,
right?
As
and that's
a
the part where it feels cynical, right? Which is like the answer is you can't do it because you'll sell more copies with Kratos on the cover.
That's possible. I'm not ruling that out, but I think you also can't remove the fact that the principal creators of the original games are the ones making this, and I think the idea of that, like. I think there was a way in which they wanted to be the ones that, like, reckon with this through the character.
Totally.
But then
we have to hold them to that standard and say they didn't do it, which is the thing that sucks, you know?
So,
sorry,
one of my
Danielle,
biggest
what were
questions. That's all right. One of my biggest questions ties directly into this, and it's sort of something you raised quite a bit, Patrick, in your review, which is sort of the datification of games as a trend, as well as sort of, you know, something that is very much happening in this game. And there's a through line there also with the other Sony sort of prestige projects, right? Especially Last of Us, which is also something you touched on in your review. And you actually quoted game critic Maddie Bryce, talking about the character of Joel and sort of comparing it to Kratos. And I'm wondering if there's something there as well about, like, is this cynical in a way, this datification sort of angle? Or is it, you know, just something that kind of you think actually speaks to the folks who made the game?
No, I think it absolutely speaks to the folks that made the game. Well, it's cynical in the sense that, yes, video games are a predominantly male-dominated industry, and so, like, it both makes sense that there's a datification of games because there's a shitload of dads that are making games, and there are a lot of people who play games that are also now dads. So that goes hand in hand, but I think you can draw a direct through line to the lack of discussing this game, the series' history with women in this new game, through the lens of, like, well, it's men wanting to talk about being a dad, right?
Yeah.
And so when, you know, again, I can't speak to, like, every design decision, but I think you can look at it in a big picture sense that the reason that lens is chosen, the reason we don't get the other reckoning, the reason we the wife, you know, they managed to make this big ass expensive game and at no point just cast a voice actress to speak for the wife, like, and give her any sort of agency in this plot, has directly to do with the fact that men were largely in charge of its creation. Right. And even you can argue that and say, well, you know, they're speaking to what they know, right? But that's not an excuse I can fully buy. If they wanted to make a game about dads and sons, they could have created a brand new universe and done that without any of this baggage. But they chose to do it within right. God of War. They choose to do
which
it,
which has this misogynistic baggage,
right?
That they don't confront. Well, and the other thing, I'll say in favor of it, which I kind of already did say, or I mean not in favor of it, but the datification of games thing is super fascinating to me because there's such a spectrum of what is on that, what is included in the datification.
Yeah.
There was a really great thread in response to Patrick's review on the Waypoint forums, discourse.zone. And on it, someone says here are a bunch of games that deal with parenthood and deals specifically with dads. And one of them is like, what's the zombie, not Dead Island, Dead Rising, Dead Rising 2, where you play as a dad who's trying to find zombie meds for your daughter, but like anti-zombie meds, it's a whole thing. But in that game, like that game's not particularly about being a dad, right? Like you happen to have a dad in that game, but it isn't digging into that stuff. I've definitely heard people defend GTA 5 as being it's a game about masculinity, and that's why it's cool that there's all these toxic dudes. And I don't think that's fucking true at all. I don't think GTA 5 digs into masculinity in any meaningful way. Like it does on the surface and on the margins, there are a couple of quests or a couple of missions that dig into it. But by and large, it's just like dudes being dudes. What's better than this?
Bros being dudes.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I genuinely think God of War is about parenthood. I do genuinely think that these creators are trying to dig into that stuff and that moments hit gold, right? They really do. And so I do want to give it credit for that. But I also do just like, there was so much here that didn't work for me in the latter half that it's hard not to come back to those criticisms about where games criticism is at or where those concerns about where games criticism is at and not worry that that by and large, the kind of review sphere, the kind of critical, and commercial, review, apparatus is so dedicated to things like polish. It's a beautiful game. I don't want to take anything away from it. It's gorgeous. Like, I don't think it has a photo mode, and I wish it did because it's one of the most beautiful games I've played.
It's they're patching it in, like, I think on day one or something.
Okay,
like
good,
that.
Good, because they will get you'll get a lot of great photos out of it. It's tremendous. There are some visual stylings here that are really great, but I also do think that, like, we as a culture of reviewers have to get better about talking about things that are not just that top level, even just that top level feel. Like, I really like the way the combat feels. I think it is weighty. I think there's like a great deal of variety possible in it, but I also don't think it actually pushes you to dig into that variety. Like, I found what worked in that game and then it carried me through across the entire game. You know, early in the game, you find out that you have a codex that gives you tips for how to fight various enemies. I never had to look at that codex. I never had, like, none of those tips fucking matter.
It's also not that type. Like, I would argue to a certain point, that is in line with God of War as a series.
Then it can't be 30 or 40 hours. Do you know what I mean? Like, because then those last 15 hours are just me doing the same thing over and over again. And it's doubly bad because
I told you this when you were playing the game, like, that you should bump the difficulty up because.
But that's the opposite of what I wanted, because what I wanted was more story, because the story was paced so poorly in that plot. Latter half. Do you know what I mean? That's the.
Sure.
It was a thing where, like, if the story pacing had been right, then you're right. I would love to have picked up the difficulty to make those fights more interesting. But because each story thing was only advancing by a millimeter, because it felt so dragged out, all I wanted to do was get to the next thing. And so I didn't drop the difficulty down. I was on the default difficulty all the way through. But they were kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place for me, if that makes sense. Which is tough. Because I love the game feel. Like, there was a tweet going around where someone was being dragged for a line in their review where they talked about how good it feels to recall the axe to you, the axe that you that that your basic weapon for the whole game is this cool axe that is like
Leviathan axe,
Leviathan axe,
something
yeah.
like that. Okay,
that's like Mjolnir. I don't know how to pronounce
it. Mjolnir.
There's a J in there. I don't know if it's a soft J or a hard J. Despite having been a Marvel guy for my whole life,
the misogyny
of the hammer, yes. Which is actually accurate for how they portray Thor, kind of in the margins of this game, kind of. You can recall it to you the way Thor can, and it feels great. And there's this line in someone else's review, I forget whose review it is, that just says, like, when you throw it really far, it takes another split second to get back to you, and that feels good. And I actually think it's, like, a really well thought out point, because it's such a small detail. They could just make it teleport back to you instantly, but it's actually, like, they really did understand how good it would feel to hear it rushing back to you when you grab it in your hand. And, like,
I would let the axe just sit, like, when I would finish a battle and I wasn't holding it, I would purposely not pick it up, wait until the next fight, and then, like, recall it back, like, hear it ding 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 against like a bunch of different things. And also, one of my favorite powers they got in the game was one where if you go into the stance where you can, so you can both hit the axe like normally and then you can toss the axe, and that plays into the puzzles and the combat, and there's like a lot of different ways you can use the toss. But like, anyway, like this one specific attack, which was like really powerful, was that if you normally you can just call it back and then do an action, but this one is you go into the stance where you're going to throw it, but then you call it back and it instantly launches Kratos into this big, like, aerial, like, ground pound area of effect attack. And I would always use that to, like, start every fight, because
it's
like
fun.
It was just extreme, there are a lot of I found the combat to be just, like, deeply satisfying. And I agree that I didn't pick up on a lot of the Dark Souls comparisons I saw, like, various folks making. Like, I just didn't see it at all.
Me either.
Mostly.
I wish.
Right. Because that's what I mean. Like, I wish that was part of the reason. I was like, I wanted the difficulty to be harder. I wish some of the end game challenges were more deeply wound into, like, the main. Like, I wanted a more punishing game, because I found often when I was switching up the skills or doing different things, and like when you get access to like a larger tool set in the latter half of the game, I was mostly just doing that because it was like interesting, but less because the game was saying, like, hey, we're gonna push you into a corner, and like, unless you do this, like, you're gonna have a lot of, like, you can't just keep banging your head, like, you're gonna have a lot of trouble progressing. And it's really only the end game challenges or the higher difficulties that ask you to start being mindful of the stuff. And while that is in line with God of War as a franchise, I found that if you didn't find it as interesting as I did to just kind of keep mixing it up, because I found just the combat loop satisfying over and over again, I don't blame you or other people who, for like halfway through, kind of checking out of it and being like, okay, well, now the story needs to pick up. And that's the exact point when the story, like, it turns into MacGuffin Central, and there are like strong moments within it, but
totally.
it's the kind of thing where the last 10 hours could have been four and been much stronger for it.
Totally.
Speaking about the combat, and I know how where you fall on this, Patrick, since I read your review, but Austin, and I guess also just generally, it sounded like Atreus is actually useful in combat, and he's not just sort of, it's not a, you know, game along escort mission or anything like that. Can you speak a little bit to that? Because that sounded really interesting to me, that you can sort of equip him with different arrows, and he's actually like,
There are parts of that game where Atreus just one fights for me. Like, I just hit, there's a button. There's like the Atreus button, right? Which is like, you hit square to make Atreus shoot an arrow. And they do a good job mechanically of having him develop as like an NPC who gained, like, you level him up in the level up screen, the same way you level up your axe combos and stuff. But also just his demeanor changes in combat throughout the game, and not only in a linear fashion, he kind of goes in certain directions and then adjusts and comes back in different ways as the story changes. And it's really actually effective, both as a storytelling thing and also mechanically, to see him kind of come into his own as a companion character. But yeah, eventually you can definitely kit him out. I kind of there's armor that gives him abilities, and I kitted him out to be just like this incredible sharpshooter to just do as much damage as possible. Patrick, I don't know which way you went with that, but like, you can have him be a healer or a support character almost instead.
No, I made him an attack dog.
Boy, he just tears shit up. It's great.
Yeah, if you spend your resources on like pumping up the damage and the speed and the volume of arrows, like you can. And then there are certain, let's say, different arrow types you can get that have different effects on the battle. There are some that have a, let's call it a large area of effect, where you can like conceivably for like just like walk Kratos around and just keep spamming the square button. But it's a very satisfying like implementation of a sidekick character. Like they found a way to both make Atreus vulnerable, like that he can die, but like it's so easy to bring him back. Like it's only meant to like kind of keep you on your toes a little bit. Yeah. But he's mostly just they took a tool that could have just been, he's just a drone, and Kratos has a drone that helps him. But it makes it, you know, the story and the gameplay integrate more fully in a way that like benefits like the relationship they're trying to build between two characters.
There's stuff we can't talk about here, they do stuff with this as well. I'll say that it's not just like. It's not, he is a drone. And then there are moments when he's like not a particularly effective drone. And there are moments when he's a really effective drone. And the way that stuff works makes him more than a drone. I'll also say there was one moment early on within the first 4 hours, like the first time I fought a troll or something, maybe the second time was the first time that he went down. I had to go over and heal him, but it was because I was dedicated to fucking killing this troll. I got caught in like an extended kill animation. And meanwhile, Atreus is just like, "Dad, help, Dad." And I'm like, I literally can't come help you. I'm trying to axe this troll in the mouth. It was a very funny exchange, and then it was one of those things where, like, I almost wish the game had acknowledged that a little bit more, but I acknowledged it. I understood the message.
It worked for you, yeah.
One small, the game's full of like really tiny details that are mindful of sort of the player experience. One of my biggest pet peeves in games that have a lot of like dialogue or conversations that kind of the game is plugging in while you're exploring, because they want to fill some of the dead air where there's no music. And this game has like literally hours of like this idle dialogue that it really great. Fills in. Like, it's not just idle. It's idle dialogue used effectively to like build deeper relationships between Kratos and Atreus. It drives me up a wall when you lose that stuff because, like, you accidentally instance combat or a cutscene happens. And there's no way to loop back around to that. Like, you just lose it. Like, you have to go look up on a YouTube video or just move on. And, like, it makes me so angry when games don't, like, you end up, like, you're doing the thing where you hide around a corner waiting for a dialogue machine to finish. And this game, like, absolutely someone on the team was like, "You know what's bad? The boy games do that." And they built in a solution, which is that whenever a conversation is happening, and I didn't even notice this was a trick until I accidentally triggered it. But like, there are all sorts of like beaches that you can go up to in the sort of like open worldly segment of the game. And if you're in middle of conversation, like, there's a very seamless transition where either Kratos or Atreus or some of the other characters you interact with will then remark, "You know what, let's pick up this story later." And then, sure enough, the moment combat is over, even if you're just on land, it won't necessarily be back in the water, the game will find what feels like a very appropriate moment to bring it back in and, like, pick up that story.
With a summary. It doesn't just go back.
Yeah.
It doesn't just go back to the line. It doesn't just say, like, you know, it doesn't even just go, like, "Now where were we?" It goes, like, "Now where were we? Oh, yeah, I was talking about the time Thor fought the World Serpent. And how he was on his last leg." It's not even just here's the title of the thing. It's like the moment it was interrupted is you're brought back to that moment in the story. It's really good. And it's used to great effect.
Okay. I'm gonna interrupt you. So Michael Cohen just lost.
All right.
Like in his he's trying to like, you know, get all this stuff that was taken from his. So he's been fighting really hard to not name who his third client was.
I'm very excited. What was his second client?
So it's Donald Trump, and then I think it was like that Republican official that like negotiated the $1.6 million over an abortion related to a Playboy playmate. The third client is Sean Hannity.
What is happening? what is this? Is too much.
The true God of War.
Right, Sean here. Hannity is a god of some. I think. Well, Sean Hannity. Speaking of God of War, Sean Hannity, of course, was in a different character action game, DMC Devil May Cry, as one of his bosses.
What?
Basically, not actually. You know, he's a little more Bill O'Reilly, that character, I guess. Danielle, you should. I'm going to link you at some point
please
to the
do.
DMC fight that is just a Fox News host.
Yes, please.
It's very please, fucking good.
Please do that. I was going to ask you. I guess this is semi-related to this shit, because all of this is mythology. It's just our real lives, but also mythology.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
How much, like, I'm a mythology nerd. I love hearing all of Norse, Greek, et cetera, Egyptian, whatever. Pretty much any culture, I love storytelling and fairy tales and mythology. How much am I going to love the mythology in this game? Am I going to nerd out a little bit here?
Yes and no. Like,
okay. Right.
There's less of it than I thought.
I wanted more.
Yeah, so I would say they definitely, like, purposely, or intentionally rather, like, try and change the general structure of, like, how these games have played out in the past, which is, like, I mean, the first game, first God of War opens with, you know, you're fighting a Hydra, and, right. like, it only gets bigger from there, and, like, you get to encounter all, like, the creatures that you think you would encounter, like, in a game set in Norse or Greek mythology, and this game, like, a lot of it is insinuation, or you'll get, like they straight up call them lore, which is like these paintings that are telling you kind of like the if you aren't familiar with like Norse mythology, like I think a lot of people may be more familiar with Greek mythology, especially if you've played the God of War games. And so this a lot of that functions as like some world building for what's happening both in this game and more traditionally. But there's not. Like, you know, the world serpent is there, you know, like that. Okay. That's been a focal point of a lot of the media. But right. There's not a lot of it to the degree that I was like pretty surprised and like you wish it had ended up leaning more into that stuff.
It felt very much like I left this game being like, all right, like Uncharted seems to be coming to a close. God of War is going to be around for the next decade. Like they're leaving cards in the deck. And I don't think Norse mythology is as well known as like Greek mythology or even Egyptian mythology in terms of like what the pantheon looks like. But there's lots of cards in the deck that are gestured at, let's say.
There are two. I would say like very
the two
maybe
big
I,
ones.
Yeah, there are Easter eggs that I missed up. And we're not going to spoil what it is.
No,
but
I'm
like,
not going to talk.
There are two paths they essentially lay out that I wonder if they're just going to see how people respond and then choose where they go from here. But there is one that is just an Easter egg, and then there is one that the stuff that Austin and I are and Danielle you may be wishing for more of would they gesture at for what like the next game would be by like the conclusion of this, and again, we're not going to get any specifics, like, would basically just be all that shit.
Totally.
And I remember talking to Rob when he was asking about how I felt about, like, where the game kind of ends, and again, very specifically, I'm not going to get into spoilers, but I worry that they're going to run into the same... It's hard
scale.
For me to see with the way they pitch where this would go from here, because it is very much a where we go from here. Like, there is a conclusion to the story that they tell, like, the going to the mountain to, you know, scatter the ashes of Kratos' wife and Atreus' mother, like that is the beginning and the end, you know, like that how they deal with that is the focal point of this. But there's very much a setup for the future, but that one that seems intent on scale. And I would that's the strengths of this game, like for the faults that it has were not that. And maybe I just want them to take that and go build a different game that is like built around that stuff, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very so that's like if I can leave on one thing and we can take a quick break. It's I'm still lingering with that question of kind of the response to this being so overwhelmingly positive. I'm not so to be clear, I'm not taking anything away from any reviewer who loved this game. I'm not saying that they are wrong for loving the game at all. Like, I genuinely understand why someone would love this game and why they would score it a 10 or say that it's whatever. You know, like I edited your review, Patrick. Obviously I hadn't beaten the game.
I'm one of those reviewers, Austin.
Right. But like even though I had a different experience with it than you did, I'm not saying that that's not an honest response.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's a problem for the industry to have reviewers who unilaterally responded to something that I think, I don't know, maybe it's not a pro. I don't know. I'm struggling with this because I think
you're right. This game is not, there should have been at least one review
from a major.
So like when I talk about like the list of priorities that I take into it, like, and I also acknowledge that like I have blinders now as a father, right? Like, so like there is like, it's not just critic bait, like there's dad bait. I ended up probably overlooking elements of the way this game deals with women because like I look at this from the lens of a father, and that is a fault of mine. That's part of the reason that I don't like reviewing things, because if I was to review this game a week later, having like had discussions with people where they like point, like if Austin and I probably talked about a moment that I'm pretty sure I know what he's talking about, or some of the way that people asked, like, hey, like, how does this deal with misogyny? I was like, wow, I didn't talk about that as much in the review as I probably should have in retrospect. Like, that then, like, the fact that those things weren't higher priorities in other reviews is not the fault of individual review. I mean, on some level it is. Like, I'm acknowledging that it's a blind spot.
Yeah, it's a blind – it's a major problem, yeah.
It's a collective problem, right? It's the fact that there aren't people in a position with a different hierarchy value to then – put that up and say, like, actually, like, this is the lens that I looked at the game through. These, like, actually, fuck this violent stuff. Like, why are we not talking about how, creators used to throw women into grinders?
But also, like, it is the misogyny thing, but I think it is also the, like, so, like, I think this game is gorgeous. I think it's beautiful. I've said this before. I think it's incredible. That doesn't in any way, and it didn't negate the fact that I think the pacing is bad in the back half.
Right.
And that's not a thing you see in anywhere else in any of the reviews. And I think that's like, I think it's partially because of the way reviews are around embargo time, where like you're rushing through games like this anyway. And so like, it's hard to judge pacing around, in the back half of games, because it always feels like a slog, because you're just like, I need to finish this game to get to my deadline. But I also think it speaks to like an aesthetic sameness around like what we think prestige games should look and feel and sound and be like. And it's so tough because whenever we do the movie comparison, it's like, yes, this is prestige for games, but in film, this is like a good Marvel movie. Do you know what I mean?
It's Black Panther. It's like, I'm saying that as a relative comparison.
Yes.
Not like
Totally.
It's Thor Ragnarok, maybe.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. I think it's probably more serious than Thor Ragnarok. Yeah. But yes. It's a good one of these. And
Winter Soldier. There we go.
Sure.
We got
there. I still haven't seen Winter Soldier. I'm a bad Marvel fan. This is the thing that's happened is I've stopped watching those movies.
I definitely want to ask about this and just talk about this for a second, because I used to review a lot of games of every sort of stripe and every sort of size. And I struggled really hard with this, too, even being a queer woman and having a lot of these thoughts about a game and being like, you know, feeling personally about misogyny and feeling very personally about those kinds of things. I definitely also felt a pressure at times to be like, well, we put that in the sidebar. You know, we talk about this. I have my feminism sidebar and then like evaluate the game almost on other terms, sort of. Like this was never like a spoken pressure, but there feels like the way you write a review sometimes does feel different from the way you might write a piece of more personal criticism. I'm not saying that is, a mandate or this is, you know, something somebody sat down and told me, but it feels weird, right? Like, or maybe I'm like, was trying too hard to conform to a voice or something like that. But do you ever feel that way? You both write reviews.
I mean, I'll say no, but largely because I feel very lucky to be at Waypoint where we don't do sidebars. We don't have the ability to do sidebars as far as I know.
We're not capable of sidebars.
But also I've always been the sort of person who's like, if it's important enough to be on the page, it should be in the text. And I do my best with, as an editor, to help find the place for that stuff. I don't think that's an anxiety only you have. Danielle, I think it's an anxiety a lot of writers have, it can be about very important political, personal, social things like identity, class, but it can also just be about like, man, I really want to talk about this side activity. I really want to talk about how much this mini game meant to me, but like, I can't, it doesn't really fit in. And so, well,
does
if it really
feel
meant,
like a review? And I know again, it that's not
right,
like,
right.
I guess I'm trying to interrogate how much is that me being insecure about being a writer in this space, and how much is this me being like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I wonder how much is shared.
I think that that's shared. I'm definitely the sort of person who's like, oh, I wrote this whole thing about how the radio works in this game. But yeah. But that is that really important? And I'm always going to, as an editor, push to, like, if it's important enough for it to be a thing that you're anxious about trying to find a place for, let's try to find a place for it and see if there is boilerplate shit that is in other reviews that we can cut. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of the example with this review, Patrick. I feel like there was definitely a section. I mean, we just reworked that. We kind of moved Atreus up, right? Is the thing that there was an earlier draft of this review where you started with Atreus' stuff at the top of the review. Which is where it ended up being. But there was part of you that was like, oh, I'm going to do a quick introduction on like how combat works so I can lean in, so then I can kind of transition into talking about how Atreus works in combat and then talk more broadly about Atreus as a character and then talk more broadly about parenthood, which is like on paper is a really good structure for this review. But what we realized was like, you can't just say one or two words about the combat. The combat section ended up being huge. And in the end, we trimmed back on that and flipped it so that we started early with the Atreus stuff because that was the emotional core and pushed you away from doing the, like, you know, there was a whole section in there before that listed all of the different items you could pick up, basically. Or not items you could pick up, but, like, all the different...
Going, like, deeper into, like, the different, like, character...
Customization.
The combat attributes. Yeah, the customization. Because, like, a lot of that is... That's like untraining, like, you know, 15 years, 20 years, if like you go back to like the stuff I was doing long before I got paid, of like just how you write reviews. Like that was like, there was the early draft of the review like touched on all the emotional and the dad stuff and blah, 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 but definitely like prioritized, like made a decision to like put up like, well, here's how the game plays and how the game feels. And I think that is generally how game critics operate because that's how game critics have been instructed, taught to operate. And the audience tends to reinforce that because they tend to value that stuff. But, you know, at Waypoint, like, we've been trying to, like, get, you know, try to find, like, with a review specifically, trying to find a way to, like, rather than the critical essay that comes a week later, like, merging that into the review and trying to find somewhere in between.
And we'll still probably do that critical essay that comes a week later also.
I don't consider an, forum goers may disagree. I don't mean Waypoint forum goers. I mean sort of like the Reddit and sort of like the larger gaming space. Like, I don't consider like my review of God of War to be like my final thought on God of War. It was like a moment in time, like an essay about how I felt then. Like, I reserve the right to like sour on that game as I like read more critical pieces about it. Like, wow, I didn't consider it that enough. Like, the things I like about it are still the things that I like about it, but like, like, that review was, like, a thing written at a moment in time, and then, like, shit changes when you read more about it and hear more about it. Like, I copped to that on Bioshock Infinite. Like, I came out of that game liking it and then came around to going, like, oh, no. Oh, no. Like, and that stuff happens. Like, it's not – it's just – it's one piece in the evolution of, like, how you feel about a product or a creation of something. And, like, that changes over time.
Yeah. Right. Right. All right, let's go to a break. Let's take a quick break and then come back and talk more about video games and maybe take a quick question. We'll be right back.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
All right, we are back. Is there any new Michael Cohen news? Any more Trump news? Anything else happening, Patrick? Any updates?
Nah, man. People are just laughing a lot. A lot of laughing. It's extremely funny.
It is extremely, extremely funny. sorry, Chris Hayes just tweeted, just OMGHFS. Great. Good.
Wow.
Perfect.
Wow.
All right. So we've been playing some other games. I know I name dropped Minute during our an endorsement section a couple of weeks ago, but I think now we've all played and beaten Minute. So I'd love to just let's just go from the biggest big release of the month, the biggest, like, high in scale, huge budget, you know, Sony first party, to a game where you play as, like, a little RPG person, and you get a minute to go do a thing, and if you don't do it, you start over, and you go from the beginning of the minute again. Danielle, you did a review for this. Can you talk a little bit about it, and we can now all actually talk some about our experience?
Yeah, happy to. It was a much shorter review. you know, I don't want to make the dumb joke that I did it in a minute, but you know, hey, I did, I guess. It's a really, really good, I think, basically takes a lot of the mechanics of a Zelda-like game. It's sort of that, not exactly isometric, but not exactly top-down, perspective of a sort of a 2D Zelda. You're a little guy. I think his name is Minute, or little person, I should say. And I think their name is actually Minute. And
yeah, I didn't put that together. I didn't get that deep
lore. I'm pretty sure their name is Minute. Huh. Could be wrong.
M-I-N-I-T, right?
Yeah, M-I-N-I-T. And you go on a sort of Zelda-style quest where, you know, in every gameplay loop, obviously you just set up that it's 60 seconds long, but you're constantly getting sort of new loot and new gear that allows you to open up new parts of the world. So there's, you know, a sort of general little town overworld area. There's a little tropical area. I'm not going to spoil anything. There's like a haunted area. There's all kinds of different areas that kind of track with the genre tropes, but it's very quirky and indie and done in this very black and white style. What I liked about it the most was how I felt like I was making progress with pretty much every loop. That was the biggest, that would have been the biggest killer for Minute. Because what's great about a Zelda game, a good Zelda game, puts you in kind of a flow state of, I'm exploring, I'm finding new stuff, I'm finding a new temple, I'm doing light combat. You know, you have arrows and you have like a little sword and in Zelda you have arrows, you have something else here, but... Like you're always kind of constantly doing something new and constantly somewhere as part of that flow. But it could have gotten broken up really badly if that minute time limit actually felt really restrictive. But it never really did. I did get stuck at kind of one point. There was like a late game quest that I got a little bit stuck on.
Danielle,
I didn't realize I had to do something.
Danielle, I want you to know that this morning I got a message from one Patrick Klepek, who said, where is it here, Patrick? Can I get a hint on Minute? I can't progress in the blank because I need one more blank at the blank to get the blank, but I can't seem to figure out who the heck would need help. And it was literally the same point
same
that you got stuck on.
Exact thing. And it's same right at the end thing. Of the game. There's like two and you things had different, you do
you
after
had different,
that.
You had different who the heck needed help answers. You each found different ones and was able to direct you both in the right direction. I'm happy. I'm happy to provide the service.
Game Master Austin helped
That's
us
me,
out quite
GM
a bit.
Austin. You already know what it is. That game is really cool. It's funny because... the thing that you just pointed out, which is you always are kind of making progress. I'm going to sneeze one second.
That's okay. Allergies.
Excuse me.
Make it happen.
It's happening. Yeah. Allergies, because not really good rhymes with allergies off the top of my head. Or they would be there, but the allergies have gotten into the rhyme zone in my brain they're messing up my allergies. One of the things you were talking about just now was that you always make progress on each run, which can mean something big, like finding a new item. And like you said, like the items stay around from run to run. So one of the first things that you find is a watering can, right? And then you can use that watering can to do things you would do with water. And so every round when you start, you kind of step out of your house and there's your watering can next to your apartment, next to your house. And you can pick it up immediately. Or you find the sword, like, is the first thing that you find in the game. It's funny to bring that up because I do not want to just dig back into God of War here. But one of the things that historically in this style of game doesn't work for me in the kind of Zelda or even in the Metroidvania style of game or Patrick, in the God of War review, you bring up Darksiders is the like, oh, I got an item that now I got a new tool that lets me go back to old areas and open up doors I couldn't open up before. That can work for me, but the game structure and loop has to be so like the kind of large picture loop, the large picture game flow has to be such that I would naturally come back to those places anyway. If it's ever the thing of like, I'm going to go check in on a place to see if I now have the key that I need to open the door. And if I go there and I do, but like maybe I only have one of two or three abilities that I need to get all the way into the final thing. And God of War does that a couple of times on side things where it's like, well, I can get through this obstacle, but now there's another obstacle behind it that I didn't fucking see before. And I don't know how to deal deal with. Minute doesn't do that at all, really. Like, Minute always, like, there are, you know, there are definitely walls that you can hit where you're like, oh, I need this other thing. But in general, because of the little 60-second loop, you're always able to find a thing to make progress on, or at least find a set of puzzles to start working on. And until the very end, you always have another direction to go and another optional thing to at least work on. You know, oh, I can go find a new heart to increase my health. Oh, I can go find one of the – there are these, like, tentacles you end up trying to get that are hidden all across the world that can give you a bonus thing when you get them all. Like, there's all sorts of little cool stuff there. And it's just – that game is paced so well and the music is so good that I just felt good moving around in it from life to life, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That game feel is great. It's a different type of game feel than what we were talking about before, but it's pretty fantastic. Hey, here. So
there is something like the Leviathan Axe by the end of that game. So it feels good to catch weapons sometimes. Patrick, what did you think of it? Did you come away digging it?
Yeah, it was the sort of like perfect antidote to God of War. Like, I still want to go back in and like kind of finish off some of the end game stuff to God of War, but I just needed to do something else. Fortnite's been good for that. Like just actually having like aesthetically different games like that aren't God of War's not grim dark, but like it's, you know, it's grim serious and it's like very violent, and there is moments of humor, but there's not a lot of levity. And so having something Minute where, and also that just that like that sense of like you're always accomplishing like a little task, like and actually that's like I think I remarked to you when I finished the game this morning before we started work was it extends out its gimmick just long enough to get to start scratching at being annoying, because it works best when the sort of options are endless, when you're still discovering what there is to do. Uh-huh. But when you actually need to accomplish like a hyper specific task, then that's when like the 60 seconds becomes like kind of grating, because like, right. I know what I, okay, I'm sorry, I moved the boxes in the wrong, like there's specifically, there's this one side quest, not side quest, it's one of the main quests that it's a side quest to one of the main quests where you have to move a box around so that someone can find something they've lost. And they're telling you like, oh, closer, 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 not close. And I had to run through that like 10 different times. Yeah. And it was just like really, this isn't fun anymore. And so it was like moments like that that would run into a wall. But the game, you know, I think I finished it in 2.5 hours. Like, it was just long enough. There's still a lot of side stuff I could do if I wanted to jump back into it. I don't know that I felt compelled enough to go keep doing that stuff. But like the main quest was just like really tightly woven, and clearly like they must have cut a lot of things to like keep you in that box.
Yeah.
And it was just, it got in and it got out right when it needed to. I'd love to play another game that just like used the gimmick. Like the gimmick. I was that tired of the gimmick. It's just that I like tired of it in the box that it was in. But like if they wanted to make another Minute, which I guess they could just, that's the name of the game, another Minute.
Good
there'd be
job.
Like Minute squared. There'd be like a little two at the end, you know. It would be
I enjoy it. I think it's well worth playing.
Make the R a two. That's how you do it.
There you go.
Make the R a two in another. God. Okay. Yeah, I like Minute a lot. I'm a big fan. I people should check it out. I think calling it the antidote to God of War is a really good, really good one. Put that on your Steam page, Minute Devs. It's like $10. It's $10. It's on Windows and Mac. And it has just like such a good main theme. I love it so much. Yeah. It makes me feel so warm and good. Y'all playing anything else lately? I guess, Patrick, we saw Below, like, it's Minute adjacent in a weird way, in that it is not, I mean, it's run-based, but your runs should last more than 60 seconds.
Yeah, I may end up writing about this later this week, because part of the problem of playing a game like at PAX, we also played State of Decay 2, I watched you and Danica play State of Decay 2. But it was a time limited 10-minute demo, and like that's just not a game.
Yeah, I did that demo a couple times, so I got a little bit of some thoughts. But
at least you know, State of Decay. But if you don't, it's a fairly useless, if anything, like bad way to understand what is interesting about that game, because it's not splashy in the way that like a more high budget zombie game might be. But Below, we actually had a chance to, you and Danica watched me play it for the better part of 2 hours.
Yeah, it was a long
really, one. Really got to dig in to the game. And I have some concerns about it, but I would say by and large, like, yo, that game is real. It seems cool, and I'm excited to see it again. I don't want to touch it again before it comes out. Like, I'm done. Like, I was like, all right, I've wrapped my head around what this thing is. My concerns, like, if I had to vocalize my concern, sort of generally, it's that I'm worried about there being enough that's interesting to do on subsequent runs, and that when I did die in the manner that I did die, I didn't necessarily feel like, oh, great, like, I'm excited to go through that first world all over again, because I'd kind of conquered how the combat works in that area, and maybe I could rush through it, and there's some ways that they mitigate that we can't get into, yeah.
What's the sort of general flow of the game itself? What's the what does that feel like typically?
I mean, it's a top down again Zelda-ish style
game.
Yeah,
for people who don't know, because it's one of those games that's been around for a while, but
yeah, it's like it's been a minute since the game. it's deeply Spelunky influenced. The world is divided into zones. The first zone is probably the one that's been in, like, all the trailers and gameplay footage, if you were to do a search for that on YouTube. It's also a mild survival game. You're collecting items and getting equipment that when you die, you can go back and grab from your body. But if you die on the way to grabbing your body, all that stuff disappears. You're kind of, a lot of the game is learning zones so that you can progress based on knowledge, which is a lot how Spelunky works. So you're not like getting you can find like stronger weapons and weapons that have different attributes, but you're not like leveling up and getting like more health so that you can get to more powerful enemies. It's more like, oh, the reason I can zip through zone one is, let's say, like, I know generally where, like, there are things in the game that are randomly generated. The individual rooms are randomly generated, but the exit to each area is in roughly the same place.
And so that area is also locked. Like, it is, like, there's a bit where, like, oh, you can take this shortcut. It's almost Dark Souls-y, where, like, there's a shortcut back to the main overworld map where you first arrive. And, like, oh, that room with the shortcut that has, like, an elevator or whatever is going to be the same room no matter what. But it might be – the rooms all around it will be randomly generated.
Okay.
Procedurally generated,
okay.
Rather.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, Patrick – will be in the same general direction.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, if you go through the loop, you know, for the eighth time, it's like I really just want to get to zone two immediately. There are ways to like sort of like create and discover shortcuts. And then B, you may know that like, oh, I just need to head to upper right. So it's just right. Like just run through the areas, like head to the upper right, and you'll find a way to get there faster. Like, I really like the combat. Like, it's simple, but in a way that is like feels very good to attack and defend and to roll. It's a very beautiful, it's a gorgeous game. Like, it's a really, really a pretty game. But the thing that Chris Piotrowski, who was a designer who was sitting with us and showing us the game, talked, and they've talked explicitly about the influence from Spelunky. But what Spelunky did so brilliantly was that every run like felt different enough because of the way systems collided in that game, with the way enemies collided in unexpected ways, so that even though you knew generally how something was going to go, there was always something weird that could happen. So you both had to be on your toes and not be surprised if it all went to shit because you just didn't expect something to be around the corner that you hadn't anticipated. And this game doesn't have a lot of those interlocking systems.
Yeah.
Or at least it didn't in the first zone. Maybe that's something that changes as you get deeper. Maybe it gets more Spelunky-ish in that sense. And that's not to say this game has to be Spelunky to be fun, but the notion of a repeatable game, a roguelike, is predicated on the idea that each run is going to keep you engaged, because that's the hook of the – if you were just to do a straight run through the game might only be – 45 minutes, which is fine. Like, that's where you're trying to get eventually, is that you know the game, have internalized the game, where you can just do the run.
I'm really curious.
Yeah, I'm curious what we haven't seen. I will say, like, the second zone, we got, like, to the beginning of that.
Right, which we shouldn't talk about.
2-hour run. No.
Too much.
We won't say what's in it, but I will say it was immediately more interesting in that sense than the first one was. So
I didn't know the right to... I didn't know it had zones. Like, that was one of those things that was like, Oh, that's what this game is. Okay, there's other, okay, like different tile sets, different enemy types, stuff like that. It was just like, oh, Spelunky, right, duh. There was a point early on when the person who was giving us the demo was like, well, you know, in caves. And I was like, what, wait, in caves, like Spelunky in caves. And I was like, yeah, in caves. Like, oh, okay, that's what this game, okay, I get it now. There's different enemies and tile, like, okay, and traps, like, okay, cool. And as soon as we got to that second zone, it was like this great moment of, like, all of my eyebrows went up and like, oh, there could be some real shit here. So I'm very curious to see how that game comes together. It's also gorgeous. It is also, like, you know, one of the big things that they did going from the previous version was it was all in 2D previously with, like, a player character who was in 3D. Danielle, I really want you to see. I would really love your eyes as someone who is, like, done with some light game dev to look at the transition from 2D to 3D here, because they went from, like, everything in the world was this faux 3D, but drawn in 2D, and now it's all actually in 3D, and it lets them do some lighting effects that are just, like, substantially improved and so clearly an extension of what their aesthetic goals were, but just, like, executed on so beautifully, where the light will diffuse in mist, or you'll see the way the grass blows in the wind or whatever. Really fucking cool. I hope that comes out soon.
I agree.
All right, good. Maybe a very quick dip in the question bucket, and then we'll wrap up today. As always, if you have a question, you can send it to gaming@vice.com. That's at Vice, not advice. Gamingadvice.com. Follow us. Hey, Waypoints. I was thinking about my latest session with Into the Breach, and that got me wondering, which games have evoked the most vivid or exciting scenes in your imagination through simple graphics, UI, whatnot, on screen? Earlier today on my screen, my steel judoka, judo mech, killed an enemy by flipping him over his head. But in my mind, the true picture was clear as day. An extremely vivid scene of a giant space bug with a military tank caught in its sights, wrapped every which way in webbing until a prime mech speeds over, wrapping it in its steel's arms around its body and suplexing it through hundreds of feet in the air. Also, while the bug squirms around, screaming out, sun glaring down on both, only to come slamming down into a lake with the force to shake all the buildings around him. With the tank free, loose webbing all around, and no prime in sight, the victorious mech emerges from the water with its dead metal stare, water drops still raining down, and standing there looking for its next target. Thanks, Ivan from Portland. Yvonne from Portland, Oregon. That's a great image.
That's beautiful.
I love roguelikes largely because of this stuff. Not that Into the Breach is a roguelike, but lots of roguelikes. Like, I've played a lot of Dwarf Fortress roguelike mode. There's an adventurer mode in Dwarf Fortress that where you just kind of pick a character in the world and can explore it and read stuff in the ancient catacombs. It's all proc-gen, and go to weird towns and take on quests and stuff. It's you know, it looks like an ASCII roguelike, or maybe you put a tile pack in, but even the tile sets are, like, either monochromatic or, like, not particularly, you know, you're not getting bright sunshine, you know, coming down through the trees. But the combat in that game does paint this really almost cinematic picture. The combat in the game always reminds me of the Ridley Scott movie. Was it Kingdom of Heaven? Not Kingdom of Men.
Oh, yeah.
Kingdom of Heaven has this, like, very specific style of swordplay that Dwarf Fortress's combat reminds me of, even though its combat is literally just a text parser that reads, like, Dwarf A did this attack on this person and hit them in the arm. For whatever reason, when I read the combat encounters in that game, it comes across as this, like, beautiful cinematic experience, like, sword fighting experience. So Dwarf Fortress is definitely the one I would go for here. How about y'all? Any things that are like, these graphics are basic, but in my mind, this is this beautiful exchange.
I mean, this is, like, a whole reason why I like pixel art so much. Like, I'm still that dork who loves good pixel art because it's just so evocative. Like, it's really incredibly beautiful to me. And I'd rather have that that sort of idea where I'm filling in the blanks in my head than necessarily seeing incredibly beautiful stuff, unless it's, like, really wild and out there and really interesting looking. Like, I was that kid who, like, in playing Super Mario Brothers, like, I had other names for everything, and I had incredibly vivid, like, mental images of like the lava itself, like boiling and roiling up and being this incredibly terrifying thing. And the like the Goombas were like really messed up, like abominations. Maybe I was a weird kid, but I saw a lot of that stuff. And there was something in the original Super Mario Brothers for the NES. There was something in the instruction booklet that said everything is a sentient being, basically, like, right. Every brick, yes. Every yes. Animal. And so I really sort of took that to heart at one point in my childhood and felt very much like this is a messed up world, you know, in my little baby child brain, thinking that way. So playing that game was more harrowing than maybe it was ever intended to be because of that, because of how vivid my imagination ran and in those years. That, and I wanted to shout out All Our Asias for having, like, really evocative, like, 3D pixel art recently that I liked a lot and thought was really cool.
Awesome. Patrick, does anything jump out to you?
Not particularly, but, like, in sort of tangentially, I'm really appreciative of games that are, like, you know, we play a lot of PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds and Fortnite, and those games getting, like, really robust replay systems because it allows you to better understand a lot of the drama in the course of actions you were participating that you just were completely unaware of and have no way of knowing, like, and sort of, like, creates this, like, much grander picture than is actually that you're aware of at the time that you're participating in the action, because there's just no, you only have what's in front of you. You don't have right. The other information. So like even like the little bit over the weekend when you and I played and I died because of this shotgun blast. And it's like, you know, these games have cheaters and like stuff like that. And it was like, well, like, how the fuck did I don't,
it
I
didn't
die
look like
all
you
the time.
Shot. It didn't look it like didn't you got look, shot.
It absolutely looked like somehow there something glitched out or there was a cheater. Like something happened. It just didn't make any sense how I died. And then it was like, let's look at the tape. And we looked at the tape, and, like, as it turns out, like, because the game, like, individually models, like, different bullets, because it's a shotgun, so it sprayed out, as this character came down, a couple of the bullets just happened to make it over a bush.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of the shot was absorbed by the bush, but a couple of bullets make it over, and you can visibly see that, and then see how the game interpreted that in killing me because I didn't have that much health, but it didn't make any sense why I should have died from the perspective I had at the pace that I was seeing the game. And in that just little 10-second moment, there is so much drama and so much like interesting things that occurred that is just unavailable to you while you were playing the game. And so the ability to slow that down, actually see that, is like on the other end of this kind of storytelling that happens where it's all built into the game. You're just not necessarily aware of how the pieces fit together. And so the ability to go back and really understand mm-hmm. that is, I find that to be like really fascinating. And I wish that stuff had been in PUBG when I was really into PUBG, because I'm sure there are so many matches that you and I had where if we just knew a little bit more how it played out, it would have made it even just so much more memorable. It makes even like that bit where I died, otherwise it's just a moment where you die. Right. But the idea that you have that bit of storytelling like makes that to the point where now I'm telling this like very basic story of just me and a person getting into a shotgun fight, which is extremely common in that game, yet it had this like real sense of drama to it that was extremely memorable. So that's my sort of like tangential take on some of that stuff.
Awesome. All right, I think that's gonna do it for us. We should go out on, as always, some I like the notion of just calling them waypoints
sure.
for the week, you know. What do you want to give a shout out to or point people in the direction of, Danielle? Anything come to mind?
All right, well, I went to an arcade this weekend.
Okay.
One of those. I mean, it was a barcade, it's fine. Kind of the only place you can find arcades in a lot of places now. And I sure did play my favorite arcade game of all time, which is Crazy Taxi. And it was actually like a Japanese cabinet, which is cool. I'd never actually played the Japanese version. And I taught my friend how to play. And there was a slight issue because the stick shifter was broken. So one of us had to like hold it on drive unless she had to go in reverse. But it was a like really wonderful moment of like sharing this thing that I loved so, so much and still love and still think is like actually a wonderful arcade game with somebody else like for the first time. And there's something special about that, being in an arcade and being able to kind of do that. So that was really fun. Crazy Taxi's great. Play it if you ever see it somewhere.
That's a good game.
Yeah.
Patrick, how about you? What is your waypoint for the week?
I want to point people towards, especially in the chaotic news environment, like where you want to disconnect a little bit, but not like fully disconnect. A year ago or so, I was turned on to an email app called Nuzzle, which basically you connect it to your Twitter account. And then every day you wake up and there's a newsletter built specifically for you that basically just takes all the stuff that your friends shared during the last 24 hours and like ranks it by hierarchy of like, here's what like the people that you follow were interested in the last 24 hours. And that was like a cool way to wake up and just kind of see stuff, especially if you were gone for the day or it was the weekend. And then I recently heard that there was an iPhone app for it. And I would highly recommend it for folks that if you're looking for ways to disconnect, but still kind of want to know what's like going on or something cool that your friends are talking about. So the iPhone app, also does that. It's the same idea, but it integrates it into push notifications. And you can get extremely granular with when it chooses to notify you. So it's not just Nuzzle, like saying, like having an arbitrary, like, hey, like people are sharing this. Like you can get down to like, do you want it within, friends you follow or friends of friends you follow? And then even more granular, is it when it hits 3 shares, 4 shares, 5 shares? So like you can set like a level of granularity over like that will essentially dictate like not only how often you're being pinged, but like sort of is this like wide across your network or is it like, oh, just like a cool nugget that like 3 people shared, like you'll get a notification about it. And I have it set at like the just the 3 people sharing, and I only get notified maybe twice a day. Like if your feed is gonna vary on how that ends up playing out, but I have found it like really cool getting pointed towards things that you know, when I'm having to shut away Twitter either during the workday because I have to write or on the weekend because I'm being Kratos, being a dad. I have found it neat to get those notifications because it allows me to feel like I can see that you know, while I'm, you know, taking care of my kid and be like, oh, that's interesting. I'll check that out later. Cause it also saves it into the app. It's like each notification you get becomes like its own little save status of whatever was shared. So you can specifically go back and find it through the app. So Nuzzle, is what I would point people.
Awesome.
To. Nice.
Well, you know, I, for me, my waypoint for this week, maybe would have popped up on your Nuzzle. It is, an
gross
article. Listen, I could have said it nuzzled up to you this morning.
Oh.
From the New Yorker as an article by Adam Davidson called Michael Cohen and the End Stage of the Trump Presidency. It is Adam Davidson is a very well, I'm trying to think of a word that is not just well respected. he's put in his fucking time as a reporter, has reported overseas, has reported nationally in fields of politics, on war, on the economy, on a number of different fields. And it is his sort of analysis of this current moment of the Trump presidency. You know, we often talk about being in a historical moment, and whether or not we can kind of see that. And sometimes we as people in, you know, non-expert roles, even those of us who care a lot about politics or who care about war, or who care about the economy, don't necessarily see the moment for what it is. And in this piece in the New Yorker, he kind of makes the case of like, hey, you know, when George W. Bush's mission accomplished sign was raised in 2003, the folks on the ground in Iraq understood what the reality was, because the reality was that that very little had been accomplished for the people of Iraq, that there was not much stability. And then extends that to talk about the moment that the economic crisis hits in 2007, 2008, where there are people on the ground who understand how toxic the kind of financial institutions and financial products that led to that recession were, and understood could see the problem, and no one was listening in a sense. Mm-hmm. And even he at the time, who was reporting on that stuff, didn't really recognize it, but there were people in his life and you know, his peers who did see it. And this is one of those pieces where like, hey, if you really need that feeling like maybe we're going to get through this fucking presidency and maybe there is going to be some notion of justice regarding Donald Trump. Not that fixes every problem by any fucking means. But
it's
that
a story.
that this particular vein of corruption and and frankly evil in American politics is going to be confronted. It's a piece that kind of builds hope for that by situating it in previous moments of recent history. Again, it is called Michael Cohen and the End Stage of the Trump Presidency by Adam Davidson. It's worth a read. It won't take up too much of your time. It's a shorty, but is still one of those good ones that makes you feel all right. All right, that's going to do it for us today. As always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Follow Bowen. You can find out more about that, rather, at waypoint.zone/BOEN. You follow Waypoint on Twitter, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice. Come over to waypoint.vice.com for all of our articles. As always, we stream over at twitch.tv/waypoint and youtube.com/waypointvice. Patrick, where can people find you on the internet?
At Patrick Clark, but and also if you find the what Austin is pointing to, interesting, Slate's Slow Burn podcast. Also,
Definitely. The Slow Burn podcast. I finished that while we were going to PAX. I listened to the first half of it on the way up, and I listened to the second half of it on the way back. That was a great podcast look at the Watergate affair.
Still Watergate. On my list. My God, I really
please
need.
Please listen to it.
Maybe in my sleep, I'll just put it on. Yeah, go to bed. Right? I'll just learn it. You know,
it's a really fascinating look again at like what's it like to be in the moment of history instead of like having the 2020 site looking back at it. Really fantastic little eight episode run podcast worth listening to. Danielle, where can people find you?
You can find me listening to all the podcasts I need to listen to at Danielle RI.
Perfect. And as always, you can find me at Austin_Walker. That is going to do it for us this week. Danielle, what do we say to him?
Be good. And be good at it.
Peace. Also, go find this tweet about Fox News needing to report that that the third client is Sean Hannity. It's very funny.
It's good.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.